tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So continue the chapter on fleshing out the four tetrads. And yesterday he was giving kind of advice on how to look for information about the developing the practice of mindfulness of breathing and the four foundations of mindfulness with other people. And this next one begins, the second way to look outside the canon for information that will fill in the gaps in the four tetrads is to experiment on your own. The canon implicitly advises this method in passages where it makes distinctions without explaining them. We've already encountered a passage of this sort in Machima 101, which he quoted in chapter 2, which we didn't read. So I'll go ahead and read that passage. It's from Machima 101. And how is striving fruitful? How is exertion fruitful? There is the case where a monk, when not loaded down, does not load himself down with pain, nor does he reject pleasure that accords with the Dhamma, although he is not fixated on that pleasure. He discerns that, when I exert a fabrication against this cause of stress, then from the fabrication of exertion there is dispassion. When I look on with equanimity at that cause of stress, then from the development of equanimity there is dispassion. So he exerts a fabrication against the cause of stress, for which dispassion comes from the fabrication of exertion, and develops equanimity with regard to the cause of stress, for which dispassion comes from the development of equanimity. Thus, the stress coming from the cause of stress, for which there is dispassion, through the fabrication of exertion, is exhausted, and the stress resulting from the cause of stress, for which there is dispassion, through the development of equanimity, is exhausted. It's pretty complicated, isn't it? I only had a brief look at that, and sort of said, oh yeah, okay. And as they're reading it out loud, it's like, whoa, okay. that's a real handful. 101. Oh, that's the same. That's similar to the one I read before. I read a part of that. Yeah, I did read this part before, but I was looking at something else in that passage. But I'll read just this short bit. And how is exertion fruitful, bhikkhus? How is striving fruitful? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is not overwhelmed with suffering does not overwhelm himself with suffering, and he does not give up the pleasure that accords with Dhamma. Yet he is not infatuated with that pleasure. He knows, when I strive with determination, this particular source of suffering fades away in me because of that determined striving. And when I look on with equanimity, this particular source of suffering fades away in me while I develop equanimity. He strives with determination in regard to that particular source of suffering, which fades away in him because of that determined striving. And he develops equanimity in regard to that particular source of suffering, which fades away in him while he is developing equanimity. When he strives with determination, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him because of that determined striving. thus that suffering is exhausted in him. When he looks on with equanimity, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him while he develops equanimity. Thus that suffering is exhausted in him. That's pretty clear. That's a helpful. Okay, we've already encountered a passage of this sort dealing with the question of whether the causes of stress are to be abandoned through exertion or equanimity. Here's another passage of a similar sort, and this is from Samyutta 46, Sutta number 51. And what is the food for the arising of unarisen rapture as a factor of awakening, or for the growth and increase of rapture as a factor for awakening once it has arisen? There are qualities that act as a foothold for rapture, as a factor for equanimity. To foster appropriate attention to them, this is the food for the arising of unarisen rapture as a factor for awakening, or for the growth and increase of rapture as a factor for awakening once it has arisen. I can remember reading that 40 years ago, and that sutta, and I think that's not really giving much information. But it is doing is saying you got to figure it out, and I think that's the whole point. What Ajahn Jeff is pointing to. Some things are explicit. According, you know, the Buddha will give very explicit direction. And some things we have to experiment with, and that's the it's a really important perspective in the sense of so often in religious teachings, and you're just supposed to sort of be spoon-fed and make the make some kind of a breakthrough with that. But the Buddha, in many, many ways, said that ehipasiko, this is a teaching to come and see. You have to come and see. You have to look for yourself. You have to practice for yourself. You have to understand it for yourself. And and then there's parameters which are very explicit in the sense, okay, if wholesome dhamma is decrease and unwholesome dhamma is increase, that's a bad move. But those are fairly clear parameters. Or if it's going to transgress some kind of virtuous conduct, it's not going to work. It's not going to end suffering. So there's explicit things, and then there's implicit encouragement to investigate and experiment for oneself. This passage is fairly opaque. It gives no indication as what the qualities acting as a foothold for rapture as a factor for awakening might be. But the opacity can be seen as serving a purpose, in that it forces you to look to your own experience, or for advice from others to discover what those qualities are. This would provide useful exercise in developing your own powers of ingenuity and discernment. Any questions on this?
Does this quote, like the equanimity versus exertion, does this correspond to the in the funeral chanting we do the dasanena paha tapa dhamma, like to be abandoned by seeing, and the other ones to be abandoned by developing? Is that the same?
Let's see. Well, I mean, I think that there, yeah, I mean, there's, because that things to be abandoned, that's very explicit in the Majjhima number 2, the Sabhasava Sutta. So those are means for which the asavas are overcome or relinquished. I think this is some things are, let's say, Yeah, and exertion, equanimity are only sort of maybe like two of the tools available, which one has to then be investigating to see what's the result? Is there relinquishment there? And also it's, example of the Sabbasava Sutta, but it's definitely not taking the standard of relinquishing of the asava. It's sort of more on a fundamental level of, is it for increase of wholesome dhammas and decrease of unwholesome dhammas? Is it for increase of mindfulness and clear comprehension? Is it for increase of tranquility, peacefulness of mind, brightness of mind? So those are standards that one starts to investigate, and but those are good. How do you say, they're a pair of somewhat apparent opposites, in the sense of, kind of, okay, you got to get in there, get your hands dirty, put forth effort in some way, or step back and watch from a distance, equanimity. I mean, those are two apparently different things, but they're also, you have to gauge, okay, what's the result? It's not exclusive, because some things do respond to effort, and some of our defilements thrive with equanimity. and some of them thrive with exertion. Like, we really feel we're doing something because we're putting forth exertion, but we're just sort of, we keep ourselves sort of wound up and tense and tight and keep ourselves as complicated as ever. Okay. The third way to look outside the canon for information that will fill in the gaps in the four tetrads is to consult books dealing with these topics. Normally, this would include the commentarial literature, such as the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purity, or the commentaries and sub-commentaries on the various sections of the canon. But in the case of breath meditation, this literature diverges widely from what the canon has to say. Beginning with step 3 in the breath meditation instructions, it tries to force the practice of breath meditation into the mold of kasina practice, a practice rarely mentioned in the canon, but which had become paradigmatic by the time the Visuddhimagga was compiled. Because of the divergence from the canon in this area, I have not chosen to draw on this literature in this book. And that's, Ajahn Jeff in general shies away from commentarial perspectives and particularly Visuddhimagga, because certainly the foundation of his own practice and his teacher's practice is breath meditation. And it is. It's quite true. There is a certain element of where a lot of the canonical description of the practice is kind of just left hanging, and there's a development of a kasina practice outside of the built on breath meditation, so it it's a bit of a squeeze, and there are teachers who completely rely on that. I think Paul Xiaodong's are a good example of that, where very faithful to the canon and to the commentaries, usually Sri Lankan tradition tends to be very strongly influenced by the Visuddhimagga. Acharya Buddhaghosa is considered considered an arahant and enlightened being. So it's Thai tradition doesn't really carry that same commentarial baggage. There's not the same. So there tends to be a lot more flexibility and leeway in exploring, particularly breath meditation, and it isn't locked into the commentarial tradition. Any questions, comments on that?
Just one comment along the lines of the, even right in the third step of the Anapanasati, experiencing the entire body, how the commentaries are very clear that
the body of the breath, yes. Yes, and that's really true in the commentaries, and it takes that body of the breath, and because the third experiencing the whole body, sabbagaya patisangveti, sabbagayas, and it's hard to the fourth step is kaya sankara, sambhayang pati sankara. So it's a calming the breath formation or conditioner. And there are places in the canon where the Buddha said the kaya, so the conditioner of the body is the breath. So it's quite explicit. Support for using the, let's say, the breath as the sole point of view of that as of calming the breath body. But the third one, sabbagaya, gaya is always the body, and sort of sabba is sort of a whole. And patisangveti is Ajahn Jeff translates it as sensitive to. Ajahn Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as experiencing the whole body. I breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I breathe out, breathing in long, experience the whole body. Breathing out long. So that using the whole body is quite practical, and I tend to agree with Ajahn Jeff in that, and I certainly feel more comfortable with getting connected with the body rather than focusing it down to just the sensation of the breath. In particular, the use of the word patisangveti, which is veti, is of course the root for vedana, feeling. I think that's why Ajahn Jeff translated it as sensitive to that feeling. And then pati, both pati and sang are amplifiers, so patisangveti, so experiencing fully sensitive to the body. Breathe in, fully sensitive to the body. I breathe out. So that's using the whole body, I think, is a appropriate basis, and where that very clear divergence of the commentarial literature, that third step going right to the sensation of the breath. Okay, although this book falls under this third general category, the main focus of this chapter will be on the three ways of looking within the canon for advice on how to flesh out the four tetrads. Drawing on insights from other tetrads, drawing on passages from other discourses that give advice on how to use the four frames of reference as themes for developing tranquility and insight, and drawing on passages that give advice on how to use other themes to accomplish the trainings contained in the 16 steps. So that's where we're getting to in this chapter. However, it's important to bear in mind that the actual practice of breath meditation will require you to look outside the canon for guidance as well. The canon was never meant to function on its own as a guide to the practice. Instead, it takes for granted a living community of practitioners who can provide apprenticeship in the practice of meditation. This is why Majjhima 95 lists the qualities to look for in reliable teachers, that they be free of the sort of greed, aversion, and delusion that would cause them to claim knowledge they don't have or to tell you to do things that would harm you. And I thought I'd read that. Majjhima 95, it's the Chanki Sutta. It's a very important sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Kosalin country with a large Sangha of bhikkhus, and eventually he arrived at a Kosalin Brahmin village named Opasada. There, the Blessed One stayed in the God's Grove, the Sala tree grove to the north of Opasada. Now, on that occasion, the Brahmin Chanki was ruling over Opasada, a crown property abounding in living beings, rich in grasslands, woodlands, waterways, and grain, a royal endowment, a sacred grant given to him by King Pasenadi of Kosala. The Brahmin householders of Opasada heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from a Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the country with a large Sangha bhikkhus, with 500 bhikkhus. Now a good report of the Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. Of course, that's our morning chanting. Then the Brahmin householders of Opasada set forth from Opasada in groups and bands and headed northwards to the God's Grove, the Salatri Grove. Now on that occasion, the Brahmin Chanki had retired to the upper story of his palace for his midday rest. Then he saw the Brahmin householders of Opasada setting forth from Opasada in groups and bands and heading northwards to the God's Grove, the Salatri Grove. When he saw them, he asked his minister, "Good minister, why are the Brahmin householders of Opasada setting forth from Opasada in groups and bands and heading northwards to the God's Grove, the Salatri Grove?" "Sir, there is the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from a Sakyan clan, who has been wandering in the coastal country," and goes through the same thing. "They are going to see the Master Gotama." "Then, good minister, go to the Brahmin householders of Opasada and tell them, 'Sir, the Brahmin Chanki says this.' 'Please wait, sirs. The Brahmin Chanki will also go to see the recluse Gotama.'" "Yes, sir," the minister replied, and he went to the Brahmin householders of Opasada and gave them the message. Now, on that occasion, 500 Brahmins from various states were staying at Opasada for some business or other. They heard, "The Brahmin Chanki, it is said, is going to see the recluse Gotama." Then they went to the Brahmin Chanki and asked him, "Sir, is it true that you are going to see the recluse Gotama?" "So it is, sir, so I am going to see the recluse Gotama." "Sir, do not go to see the recluse Gotama. It is not proper, Master Chanki, for you to go to see the recluse Gotama. Rather, it is proper for the recluse Gotama to come to see you. For you, sir, are well born on both sides, a pure maternal and paternal descent 7 generations back, unassailable, and impeccable in respect to birth. Since that is so, Master Junkie, it is not proper for you to go to see the recluse Gotama. Rather, it is proper for the recluse Gotama to come to see you. You, sir, are rich, with great wealth and great possessions. You, sir, are a master of the three Vedas with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology, and the histories as a fifth. Skilled in philology and grammar, you are fully versed in natural philosophy and in the marks of a great being. You, sir, are handsome, comely, and graceful, possessing supreme beauty of complexion with sublime beauty and sublime presence, remarkable to behold. You, sir, are virtuous, mature in virtue, possessing mature virtue. You, sir, are a good speaker with a good delivery. You speak words that are courteous, distinct, flawless, and communicate the meaning. You, sir, teach the teachers of many, and you teach the recitation of the hymns to 300 Brahman students. You, sir, are honored, respected, revered, venerated, and esteemed by King Basenati of Kosala. You, sir, are honored, respected, revered, venerated, and esteemed by the Brahman Pokarasati. You, sir, rule over Upasada, a crown property abounding in living beings, a sacred grant given to you by King Basenati of Kosala. Since this is so, Master Chunky, it is not proper for you to go to see the recluse Gotama. Rather, it is proper for the recluse Gotama to come to see you. Start to get a window on Indian culture and society of the time. what was important. When this was said, the Brahman Chunky told those Brahmins, "Now, sirs, hear from me why it is proper for me to go to see Master Gotama, and why it is not proper for Master Gotama to come to see me. Sirs, the recluse Gotama is well born on both sides, of pure maternal and paternal descent, 7 generations back, unassailable and impeccable in respect to birth. Since this is so, sirs, it is not proper for Master Gotama to come to see me. Rather, it is proper for me to go see Master Gotama. Sirs, the recluse Gotama went forth, abandoning much gold and bullion stored away in vaults and in lofts. Sirs, the recluse Gotama went forth from the home life into homelessness while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the prime of life. Sirs, the recluse Gotama shaved off his hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness, though his mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces. Sirs, the recluse Gotama is handsome, comely, graceful, possessing supreme beauty of complexion, with sublime beauty and sublime presence, remarkable to behold. Sirs, the recluse Gotama is virtuous, with noble virtue, with wholesome virtue, possessing wholesome virtue. Sirs, the recluse Gotama is a good speaker with a good delivery. He speaks words that are courteous, distinct, flawless, and communicate the meaning. Sirs, the recluse Gotama is a teacher of the teachers of many. Sirs, the recluse Gotama is free from sensual lust and without personal vanity. Sirs, the recluse Gotama holds the doctrine of the moral efficacy of action, the doctrine of the moral efficacy of deeds. He does not seek any harm for the line of Brahmins. Sirs, the recluse Gotama went forth from an aristocratic family, from one of the original noble families. Sirs, the recluse Gotama went forth from a rich family, from a family of great wealth and great possessions. Sirs, people come from remote kingdoms and remote districts to question the recluse Gotama. Sirs, many thousands of deities have gone for refuge, for life to the recluse Gotama. Sirs, the good report of the recluse Gotama has been spread to this effect. That blessed one is accomplished, fully enlightened, blah, 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 teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. Sirs, the recluse Gotama possesses the 32 marks of a great being. Sirs, King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha and his wife and children have gone for refuge, for life, to the recluse Gotama. Sirs, King Basenadi of Kosala and his wife and children have gone for refuge, for life, to the recluse Gotama. Sirs, the Brahman Pokarasati and his wife and children have gone for refuge, for life, to the recluse Gotama. Sirs, the recluse Gotama has arrived at Opasada and is living at Opasada in the God's Grove, the solitary grove, to the north of Opasada. Now, any recluses or Brahmins that come to our town are our guests, and guests should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated by us. Since the recluse Gotama has arrived at Opasada, he is our guest, and as our guest should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated by us. Since this is so, sirs, it is not proper for Master Gotama to come to see me. Rather, it is proper for me to go to see Master Gotama. Sirs, this much is the praise of Master Gotama that I have learned, but the praise of Master Gotama is not limited to that, for the praise of Master Gotama is immeasurable. Since Master Gotama possesses each one of these factors, it is not proper for him to come to see me. Rather, it is proper for me to go see Master Gotama. Therefore, sirs, let all of us go to see the recluse Gotama. Then the Brahman Chanki, together with a large company of Brahmins, went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with them. With this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down to one side. So that I think in the, these are qualities of Indian kind of culture values that are really have the. One sees, oftentimes I've thought of, you know, really like, in the commentary literature, they say, like a fully enlightened Buddha only arises in India. And you first read that and you sort of think, oh, that's really, you know, kind of nationalistic tripe, you know. And, but then you start, you know, the more familiar you get with Indian values and Indian cultural mores, then you really say, yeah, it's really hard for a fully enlightened Buddha to be born anywhere else than India. Because you don't there has to be a context for that, and there's this value that is within the culture of the time, and through Indian culture up to today, the value of a samana. You know, the value of virtue and the value of seeking truth, those are our thing, and that should be supported. I think even today, in India, as you know, India is probably got one of the largest economies on the planet, and even today you have pictures of say like the Kumbh Mela, and you have hundreds of thousands of ascetics gathering. In of course, you've got a population of a billion, and there's room for lots of but that value is very strong, and that sense of even for I remember for myself, even though Buddhism really present for say 1,000 years in the northern India. You remember walking Tudong with the bowl and robes and no lay attendant, getting in northern India and being not just looked after, but being really cared for. And even though they didn't know what what a Buddhist monk was. There was a religious seeker, and as soon as they saw that it didn't carry money, then that was a really big deal. The sense of the recluse Gotama has arrived, and he is our guest, and our guest should be honored. That's something that is still very much a part of Indian culture, and that sense of looking after the guest, looking after the and giving that respect and care as a guest, whether they're samanas or not samanas. It's quite interesting. Any questions?
It's just my curiosity. I've been wondering about this for a while. Whenever the suttas start, they always, they say they bow, they exchange greetings, and then they sit to one side. What does the sit to one side mean?
Good question. They're, because usually it would be, how many people can get on one side? It must be an idiom in the Pali. That's just a guess. The reality, of course, is because you have descriptions of the Buddha giving teachings, and with the monks behind him and the lay people in front of him, sort of in a hall, I don't know, the Pali wallows here. Any sense of where that is, that idiom comes from, or the? I assume it's just an idiom.
I always just assumed it meant something about some respectful way of sitting for some reason.
Yeah, well, it certainly is. It's very a bit more explicit when one's taking leave of the Buddha, in the sense one always keeps one's right side to the as one is taking leave, so that I assume it might have that same connotation of respect that is being given to being in the presence of somebody who is respected.
Yeah. This is just a guess, but I know in some integrals of Japanese culture, there's certain similar kind of mannerisms done, but a lot of kind of came up through trying to show that one is unarmed or not.
Mm, right.
Going to do harm to the other.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So that makes me.
Yeah, I mean, that's all the whole, sort of like in Western culture, the shaking hands and approaching, it was always keeping the right arm, or even in, say, our own wearing of robes, it's your right arm, your right side that is, your right shoulder is exposed. We are in kind of a cold culture, so we cover both shoulders with something underneath, in terms of how most people are right-handed, so then that would be tend to be when you keep a weapon in, so that making that exposed.
When you just mentioned, it reminded me too of the goose sitting behind, the lay people sitting in front. That's maybe sitting to one side is not like the Buddha's left or right, but just sitting in front of him instead of sitting surrounding him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be. Yeah. We're not going to get through this sutta today. Well, to be continued tomorrow. Okay.